Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. I'm Charlie Carter, and I'm here with Tim Little and Andy Stearns. Let's jump into the conversation.
Is that from Living in Amish
Paradise? Yeah.
Yeah.
I was about to say I'm spending all my... Anyways.
We might have just been recollecting lyrics of a Weird Al song. That's a parody of a not good song.
What's Weird Al?
Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast. Oh, good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
We've had some technical issues, but we figured them all out. And we looked in Proverbs and we found that one proverb in Proverbs 32 that says, if you have an old USB extender, you should replace it because it's probably broken.
From like at least 2003.
This is the path of wisdom.
You know, it was an old one.
All right. What are we drinking? Or we're guessing.
I have been trying to figure this out. I think it's maybe South American, maybe like a Guatemalan or a Honduran or a Costa Rican. I'm not really, those aren't my main go-tos. I don't think it's Colombian.
Is it light or dark?
My first sip, it felt darker than lighter. So I would go with like a blended Brazil is my guess.
I think it's a medium light.
But you think it is a light?
I think it's a,
It felt darker to me on first sip, but mine's cooled down now and it's lost a lot of its oomph.
It's got a little bit of bright now that it's cool. So I would say it's a medium light. And I would say Costa Rica, Honduras, or Guatemala. He's saying Brazil.
Not bad. So we're drinking.
It was right there the whole time.
Embassy Coffee Company, Nicaragua.
No way.
It's a light roast. So
we were on the same continent, Charlie.
Does Nicaragua border any of the countries that we mentioned?
My South America geography is not
getting out my map.
All right. While he does that,
no, we don't need to know.
Listener interaction.
No, we don't.
We have a listener that emailed in, and Tim is going to answer that.
Yeah. Brianna Hake wrote us middle of December, and I wasn't sure about making this a content or just reference it. We're just going to talk about it here real quick. So she writes, I have a question. What place is there for women in the field of biblical academics? So you can kind of see how that could be like a whole episode. But continuing, a year or so ago, I asked Dr. Little about what kinds of academic jobs academic jobs I could look into, suggesting maybe professorship. And he very kindly said that I should study biblical femininity. And I did. And the reason for that is because if you're going to jump into something like academics, then you need to understand also just how God has naturally wired women. And that is generally more towards the home if you want to delve into this field. So I actually have a neighbor and his daughter is pursuing academics. And as far as opportunities in academics, there are huge opportunities for women in academics right now, because everybody in the Christian world's bought into basically we want women's perspective on exegesis. So female authors are being published and so on and so forth. So I even informed my neighbor of this, but I also kind of comes with a warning. Like, you need to know what you're going to be jumping into and how it's going to be. It's a different calling than what's normal. So there's that component to it. You need to be extremely grounded in your theological system and your beliefs. For example, you know, I talked to my wife and I'll put it this way. You need to have a very healthy fear of being led astray as you go into this world. I talked to my wife and she doesn't like reading feminists, and it's because she's scared, like in a healthy way, okay, that she's going to find it persuasive. And so I've even thought about on our podcast having an episode where I'm trying to persuade people that egalitarianism is right, because they aren't idiots. They're very smart and their arguments are persuasive. So my wife has a healthy fear of that. That's what I would say. And you would want to have that healthy fear as well. So those are just kind of a couple of things about women in academics that I would encourage you to think through. First, study biblical femininity. Know exactly what it is that God has designed in creation. And then recognize, okay, my calling is going to be a little different. And then second, you need to be supremely grounded in what is right, because it'll be very easy for you to be led astray from a at least what we believe here of faith. Okay.
Wonderful. Do you have anything you'd like to say about the bookstore, Tim?
No, not really.
All right.
Can I go back to geography?
Yes.
So just pulling up my map, directly next to Nicaragua on the other side, like on the northern side, Honduras. Directly below Nicaragua on the, like, the only two countries it touches, except for maybe a little bit of Belize.
Give it up.
Costa Rica. I literally named both neighbors. And then if you go just the next one to Honduras, Guatemala. That was okay. I'll take that.
That should count as academic qualification.
I should teach a class on coffee.
All right. Here is what is in this episode. We are going to have books in business, and we're going to try something new for this episode, which might be a mainstay. I can't remember exactly what we called them, but we're going to...
A quote, a comment, and a review. You had a great name.
A comment or a review. So you'll hear one of us share a quote, you'll hear, or a comment, like a shorter kind of comment on a book. And then there could be a full review. We might have all those today. And then the person with the main content, that's kind of like a book on steroids. So they might not have a book.
That's good.
So I think Tim and Andy and I each have books to talk about. And then the main content is going to be from Josh. And he's going to talk about Nica something ethics, to quote Tim from earlier.
Right. Nicomachean ethics.
Nicaraguan? Oh,
Nicaraguan ethics?
No comment.
And
Josh just looks so disappointed with
just
us.
Just roll your eyes.
You know when your parent is like not mad at you, they're just disappointed.
Disappointed.
That was now.
I used the word horrendous. You could go with no comment. I mean, that's nicer, maybe. I don't know.
So Andy, why don't you go first?
So this week I'm going to read a quote from a book called Apologetical Aesthetics, edited by Mark Coppinger. It's a series of essays that attempt to kind of think about aesthetics with an apologetical angle to it. And the chapter I'm currently on is called Fantasy, Fairy Stories, and Understanding Free Will. And so the author here is attempting to say, when we read good stories, it does stuff to us. And he was kind of getting to this one part that I thought was a really good point. He said, the fairy story is not proof for the Christian worldview or even for specific Christian truths, but it guides the Christian to understand, interpret, and apply what he believes. And here's the quote. Just as joy is experienced by children long before linguistic and reasoning skills are available to analyze the concept, stories bring the reader to an imaginative grasp of weighty or complex subjects. And I thought that was interesting. It is as though I could read a story and understand something and experience something before I can comprehend it in life. And so there might be parts of the Christian worldview that by reading the narrative, that's a good thing. So, author of this chapter, George Skondras. George from Georgia. Ooh. So that's why I was reading it. This came out like 2 years ago, I think, and it's his chapter in the book. I'm going to read this. So there you go.
That's cool. So I have a quote from the brothers. Josh, how do I say it?
Karamazov. Sure.
Okay. And every time I'm like, how do I say that word? Brothers K is so much easier.
I always thought it was Karamazov, but
Karamazov.
I'm not a literary
Karamazov. Guy. Karamazov. Anyway, Google. Do I go with the long version of the quote or the short version of the quote?
Long. How long are we talking long?
It's a pretty girthy paragraph.
I better do short then.
Okay. So I'll read the short one.
You sighed when I said long. I'm like,
look,
you should
how long
just
it would be all of this and that.
Oh no! Well, you asked, and then so I said long,
it's
and you're like,
two pages is the full paragraph.
Well, you better just do the short.
It's horrendous.
So I'll just say that way. It's a guy reflecting on the book of Job, and right before it, he has said, "How does Job, at the end of his life, even love his new kids, having lost the old ones?" So like it's a monk trying to figure out how to interpret Job, kind of. And here's the quote that I was like, ooh, and I wrote it down. Here's the quote. "It's the great mystery of human life that old grief passes gradually into quiet, tender joy. The mild serenity of age takes the place of the righteous blood of youth. I bless the rising sun each day, and as before, my heart sings to meet it. But now I love even more its setting, its long slanting rays, and the soft, tender, gentle memories that come with them, the dear images from the whole of my long, happy life. And over all, the divine truth, softening, reconciling, and forgiving." And so I really like that the mystery of human life is how old grief turns to tender joy. And it's just a quote. I'll make no comments.
So my book is Recovering from Purity Culture, subtitle, Dismantle the Myths, Reject Shame-Based Sexuality, and Move Forward in Your Faith by Dr. Camden Morgante. I don't know how to say her last name. Purity Culture book again. I've read a few of these. They're becoming a dime a dozen. This is a very integrationist book. So that would be one observation. On page 21, she writes, "There are many excellent books on sexuality, both Christian and secular, some of which I recommend in Appendix 2. She kind of deconstructed in her faith, and then she came back to Christianity. And so she kind of tells that story. It's a bit of a personal book because she lived through purity culture. She believes, lied to. And so she's trying to speak the truth. As far as her theological background, on page 30, she writes, "As gender essentialism, the belief that men and women are essentially and inherently different, and those differences are designed by God, and patriarchy, the belief that men are the head and leaders of society and women are the subordinates, creeped into mainstream theological beliefs about gender, purity culture began to creep into Christian theologies about sexuality. The two have become so entwined that we have difficulty separating God's truth from what is cultural, man-made myth. But instead of attempting to disentangle them and search for nuance, the dominant approach has often become getting rid of both the bathwater, purity culture, and the baby, a Christian sexual ethic." So that's kind of where she's at and where she has struggled, is that she's like, well, this is messed up. And so then as a result, she's like trying not to throw the baby out with the bathwater in her language. Let's see here. So there was this other quote. Yes, here we go. Okay, so this is kind of her theological background. This is back at page 18. "Looking back, I largely attribute my deconstruction to the teaching of purity culture, patriarchy, and legalism. Over time, I gained distance and perspective from the ideology in which I was raised. I began to identify how so much of what I had been taught by purity culture were myths. I studied and eventually wholeheartedly endorsed egalitarian theology, which promotes gender equality and mutual submission rather than a hierarchy with men at the top, and embraced my identity as a Christian feminist." So if you're kind of wondering, well, where is she at least I appreciate that she's open. What many of the books that I'm reading on what this topic, they're like saying, oh, I'm not a complementarian, I'm not an egalitarian either. I'm like something
a biblicist.
Between. Yeah, exactly. And honestly, I just am sick of it. You're an egalitarian. Okay. Just take the label. Sure. There's some aspects of egalitarianism that you don't like. Sure. But you're still an egalitarian. She just outright admits, I'm an egalitarian. She continues to state, "My theological studies in grad school aided my search for biblical truth. Yet through the deconstruction process, I maintained an identity as a Christian." So she still identifies as a Christian, as a feminist that is anti-patriarchy. And what was that other thing? It was like against, I guess, just the purity culture. So what do I do with this? You know, where do you go with it? There's like a sympathy that you almost have for people who've gone through some of the problems and difficulties of purity culture. But it's an integrationist model and it's gospel-less. And I need you to understand that the way forward isn't biblical. So on page 37, she has this section on how do we heal. So like you've gone through some difficult times, you know, how do you, what's the way forward? And she talks about basically we need a new understanding, true helpful beliefs, and a new experience bodily, emotionally, and spiritually in order to change. And she quotes some psychologist. So psychologist, think integrationist, okay? And what do you think of this model of moving forward? You've been hurt in the past. Now, what's the answer? You need to create new experiences. What would the gospel say?
Well, not just create new experiences. It would be trusting in the Lord and repenting, I would think.
That's the component that I saw that was completely missing. Oh. The whole component of a repentance and even forgiveness. Mm-hmm. So let's say that you have been hurt. Well, this is what's liberating about the gospel is forgiveness. Yep. Yep. There's like no Bible in this book at all. None. Because it's a secular psychology type of a book that's mm-hmm. then using Christianese language. And she's ripping, I would say, a lot of people that I agree with. So yes, there were problems with purity culture. Does she provide the solution? No, she doesn't. Okay. She's like creating more experiences without dealing with the problems in the past. She would say she is dealing with them, but more problems in the past from a gospel perspective.
What I do appreciate is her open truthfulness about her position. I think that's part of what is bothersome is when, like, there was a while back, there was a person who said, I'm not going to be a Calvinist. I'm not going to be an Arminian because I don't want to follow men. I just want to follow the Bible. But that's very disingenuous. And I think the person was just ignorant. You're following a path that matches up with one of these because those are the two options. And it sounds like she's at least saying I'm egalitarian. And I think that's the truthfulness of that I really love because then I know and then I can deal with her. So I agree with you. I think that part's really good. She's open about it.
She talks about her theological education. I think part of it where she can talk about her positions because she actually has refined them. Like she's a scholar. So thinking through woman in academics, she is an academic. She's not super academic, but she's got some notes and stuff.
Does she give any indication of her past? Like, does she spell out in detail where she came, like what it came out of? Or is it more like I was a legalist and I was traditions and, but is it just more like a passing comment or does she detail that at all in like a biographical way?
Yeah, she gets into her biographical past some and just the lies that purity culture told her. So she calls them the myths.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I would say that the another caution there, it's when you read a biography of someone telling their story, if you have any experiences that are similar to that biographical telling, the temptation can be to say, hey, the same solution. I had the same experience. But when you retell your past, you don't always say everything. And so even if a listener were to read that and say, hey, I've had those same experiences, it wouldn't totally mean that this is accurate. It just means that some of those are similarities, but that doesn't mean the solution is accurate. That's another thing. It can be really appealing when the biographical part is there.
No, that's a really good qualification. Excellent.
Well, let's have a conversation about Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle. So quickly, just to give some highlights, but Aristotle dates 384 to 322 BC. And he's, of course, the famous student of Plato. Aristotle's parents die when he's 13, and he's, you know, watched by a guardian of some sort for a couple of years. Then he's sent to Plato's Academy, and he stays at Plato's Academy for 20 years. Eventually, in his 40s, he's invited by King Philip II of Macedonia to come and be tutor of Alexander the Great. At least that's what tradition says. And 10 years later, he returns to Athens and he starts his own school, the Lyceum, and eventually dies at age 322. And I had a quotation from the beginning of my copy of Nicomachean Ethics, and I thought I would read this because this is important to think about what his contribution is to Western civilization. Not all of Aristotle's works survive, but those that do run to more than 20 volumes in a standard Greek-English edition. The range of subjects covered by those works is astounding, from logic and rhetoric to morals and politics, to biology and physics, to metaphysics, what Aristotle himself referred to as first philosophy. In brief, Aristotle took as his proper study the whole world, or the world as a whole, from the subhuman, plants and animals, to the human, moral and political life, to the suprahuman, the cosmos, including the nature of being itself.
So he said that metaphysics is first philosophy? Huh, that's interesting.
Yes, so
I just wrote that down. I'm like, oh, that's good.
And I have also heard that Aristotle referred to metaphysics as theology.
Yeah.
Within metaphysics is his idea of the uncaused cause or the prime mover. And so he traces everything back. And of course, that prime mover is really impersonal. It's not the way you and I would think of God, but he's taking everything back to a first cause.
That's fascinating.
And all of these things are kind of related. So today, Nicomachean Ethics is a very practical work. And let me just say to the listeners, I myself, for many years, resisted reading Aristotle. And people would ask me about it, and I would say, I like Plato much better than Aristotle. And part of that is because of the way people I knew talked about Plato. And Plato's obviously an idealist, which in some ways we are more sympathetic to, perhaps. But over the last year or so, I've turned my attention more to Aristotle and have found him, yes, a little bit drier than Plato at times, because Plato has dialogues and drama. But Aristotle, I've grown in my appreciation of him tremendously. Reading his works really helps you learn how to think well. So I've appreciated him. And Nicomachean Ethics is very practical. It obviously, it deals with the virtues and how we live with one another. The pursuit of the good life is a primary concern of this text. And within Nicomachean Ethics is his idea of the golden mean. And so Aristotle describes virtue as something that exists between two extremes that are vices. So those, in one sense, if you would be deficient of a virtue, that would be one vice. And on the other end of the spectrum, you would not be deficient, but would be excessive. So between deficiency and excess. So for example, courage is the virtue, and that is the mean between cowardice, which is a deficiency of courage, and recklessness, which is an excess of courage. So that idea comes from Nicomachean Ethics. He deals with justice as well. Interestingly, he deals with justice in one book. And what we're going to talk about today is his dealing with friendship, which actually occupies two books in the Nicomachean Ethics, which is interesting that he spends two books discussing friendship. So, did you have something? Okay. So let's turn our attention here. Just going to give a quick overview, look at a couple more things in depth. But he says in the opening chapter of book 8, for friendship is a certain virtue or is accompanied by virtue, and further, it is most necessary with a view to life. Without friends, no one would choose to live, even if he possessed all other goods.
Hmm. Wow.
So you see there his high view of friendship. If you had all other goods and were self-sufficient in all other ways, you would still choose to have friends. And it reminds me a little bit of Adam and Eve. I know that's maybe not the exact same thing there, but this idea that Adam has no friend comparable, right? So,
yeah, like, so Ecclesiastes, it is, a lot of people believe Ecclesiastes was written around 300 BC, the same time frame as Aristotle. Because like chapter 4 talks about how living life by yourself is just, it's not the way God designed it. So there are several correlations between Greek thought in Ecclesiastes, which is why they've kind of dated it along those lines. But anyway, that's one of those veins of thought. But yeah, that's really good.
Yeah, thanks for adding that. So he begins in chapter 2 then of book 8 to describe what is lovable. And he concludes that what is lovable is what is good, what is pleasant, or what is useful. And these then become his three kinds of friendship. So there's a friendship that's based on goodness, and this he defines or describes as complete friendship. It's a friendship of those who are good and alike in point of virtue. And so this is the highest kind of friendship, this friendship of goodness. And he says, yet friends of this sort are likely to be rare, since people of this sort are few. Further, there is also need of the passage of time and the habits formed by living together. And so people like this are few. People who base friendships on virtue or goodness are few. And he says it's also difficult to have these friendships because you need to live together with these people for a long period of time. And so you think about those kinds of friendships, and of course, in our world where we're very transitory and we move a lot, it's difficult to establish some of those deep friendships over time. He then also discusses the friendship that's based on usefulness or utility and the friendship that's based on pleasure. And friendships based on usefulness or pleasure are more easily dissolved and more apt to change. And this, of course, makes sense to us if you think about these things. If you're looking for someone and your friendship is based on the usefulness of another person, when that person no longer becomes useful to you, you quickly move on to another person who is useful to you. He references this kind of friendship as being, you know, throughout society, but interestingly, he talks about older people establishing friendships of usefulness. And friendships of pleasure, very similarly, are easily dissolved because when a person is no longer providing pleasure for you, you look to somebody else who's going to provide it. And he associates friendships of pleasure, again, with all levels of society, but he focuses in on youthfulness. They often establish friendships of pleasure. So he moves then to consider friendships that are based on usefulness and pleasure more specifically. And he says that these friendships, they're actual friendships. They do resemble complete friendship or friendship based on goodness, in that friendships based on goodness are also pleasant and beneficial to each other. So if you have a friendship of virtue or of goodness, and I would like to think a group like this is one of those kinds of friendships, it is true that we are useful and beneficial to one another as well, but not in the same way as these friendships of usefulness and friendships of pleasure are. And the difference is that these friendships of usefulness and friendships of pleasure are based on mutual exchange or a kind of reciprocity that is different from the higher level of friendship. So people in these friendships, they may be similar. They may have similar needs or desires. They may also be quite different in terms of age, power, honor, wealth. So what preserves a friendship between a superior person and an inferior person, for thinking in terms of status or wealth or something like that? And his answer to that is that each must receive something from the other that each perceives as beneficial or pleasant. So going on from there, he eventually is going to apply this idea of mutual or just exchange and friendships of utility and pleasure to larger communities as well. So he begins to think a little bit about politics. And by the way, Nicomachean Ethics does lead right into his book, Politics. And so he's interacting with some of these things, but just thinking about what keeps a community together, and it's benefit and pleasure, right? And we would hope maybe some virtue as well, but we have this kind of social contract with one another. And he goes from that then to discuss communities that are smaller than our political communities. He looks at the home and the household, and he goes through and he discusses three regimes and then the perversion of those regimes. So you have a king and then a tyrant, an aristocracy and an oligarchy, and a polity and a democracy. And then he maps those onto relationships within the home. And so, you know, just to give you an example, the king would be the father and his relationship with his children. And he can be a king, a benevolent king, or he can turn tyrant really quickly. And then he talks about husband and wife, and they're more like an aristocracy where the husband is leading, but he's also allowing his wife to do things that she does well and those kinds of things, as opposed to an oligarchy where this select set takes over the control and power of everything. and so on. So we won't get into more of that, but it's kind of interesting that he continues to go down this path.
That's fascinating. That's really fascinating.
Thinking back then to his distinctions of friendship. So friendships that are based on usefulness and pleasure, because they are based on mutual exchange, they are prone to problems in a way that friendships based on virtue or goodness are not. So especially when one is superior to another. If you think about that, you can just kind of make sense of that pretty logically. Let's just say the king, for example, that is friends with somebody who's lower than he is, a menial. As soon as that friend who's lower or inferior to him isn't providing what the king desires, problems arise. Or when somebody inferior isn't receiving from somebody superior what he or she thinks he needs, then problems arise. And there's also this idea with reciprocity. You know, we think of this in terms of gifts. I give you a gift, Boxing Day, and I expect...
Whoa.
I expect a gift in return. It's
a quid pro quo.
Right, it's a...
The gift in return is knowing that you supplied a reader with a good book.
We can add a quid pro quo to Boxing Day. I'm not opposed to that.
And so he talks through usefulness. He writes, but friendship based on utility is prone to accusations. For those who use each other with a view to some benefit always want more and suppose they obtain less than what is proper. Book 9, he continues that discussion related to friendships based on pleasure. And eventually, he begins to consider friendship based on virtue. So he's gone through pleasure and utility, and he's shown how those function. He's discussed that they're prone to accusations and they're prone to dissolve quickly. And now he's going to focus on complete friendship or the friendship of virtue or the friendship of goodness. So if we recall his description of this friendship, it's complete friendship in that it's a friendship of those who are good and alike in point of virtue. And so if you think about that, what he's saying is you are engaged in these friendships of virtue or goodness with other people that are very similar to you in virtue and goodness and also in pursuing what is noble, which we'll talk about in a moment. And so the thoughtful person might say, well, if those are the people that you're friends with, isn't that akin to a kind of self-love? If you're liking people that are very similar to you, isn't that like as though you're liking people that are very similar, you know, that are like you? Isn't that a kind of selfishness or self-love? And so he spends some time then kind of describing this. And he says, well, actually, there's an ignoble self-love and there's a noble kind of self-love. Ignoble self-love is a self-love in which you seek to satisfy the non-rational part of your soul, your passions or your appetites. He writes, this self-love is motivated by the passions and is thus selfish. Those who grasp for more of these things, things like money, honors, bodily pleasures, gratify their desires and in general their passions and the non-rational part of their soul. Such is the character of the many. So many people pursue those things. And he says, criticizing that kind of self-love is entirely justified. But that's not what he means in these relationships or friendships of goodness or virtue. The self-love that he finds there is a noble self-love. And this is where this gets a little bit maybe complicated for people in our circles and for us even. But he says, in contrast, a person who allows the rational part of his soul to be authoritative, this person will take seriously that he himself does what is just or moderate or whatever else accords with the virtues. So this person would appear to be more of a self-lover because he does what is good and noble and ultimately beneficial to himself. He says also, as a result, the good person ought to be a self-lover. He will both profit himself and benefit others by doing noble things, but the corrupt person ought not to be. He will harm both himself and his neighbors since he follows his base passions. Every intellect chooses what is best for itself, and the decent person obeys the rule of his intellect. Now that sounds maybe, you know, somewhat strange to say that. And of course, we would accept this idea that we're fallen human beings. But what Aristotle is suggesting is the virtuous person it's as though the virtuous person is no longer set in this scenario in which he has to choose between the bad and the good. The virtuous person is just consistently, constantly choosing the good, because his mind knows that the good, pursuing the good, the noble, is ultimately what leads to my happiness and to the happiness of others. And so that's what Aristotle means by this kind of self-love.
So, you know, he's contrasting this intentional inclination of the will idea with the passions. It almost sounds stoic. And I don't know the basis of stoicism, if that flowed out of Aristotle or whatever. And I don't know, that just kind of, that quote kind of was leading me down that path. Maybe that's not justified, and that he would be more of like, he may be the cultivation of the affections and through the inclination of the will. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't have any direct thoughts, I suppose, or really informed thoughts other than to say it might be stoic in some ways, but I do think it's more related to kind of virtue, the proper cultivation of the desires, is what Aristotle's getting at there.
From the very limited exposure I have to Stoicism, I don't know that they're really concerned as much about virtues. It's more about, I want to be disconnected to where I'm always consistent and nothing outside affects me. I think that's what Pennington was pointing out, and I could be wrong. So this does sound like it's more focused on the virtuous. Not that Stoics didn't want to have virtue, but...
Right. For them, the virtue was being in complete control of their responses to whatever circumstances are coming their way. That is the chief virtue. Aristotle is seeing virtue as something that's beneficial to other people as well. And so just to wrap up, the final chapters of Book 9 are really quite interesting. He considers whether the happy man needs friends, because if you're pursuing the good and you're pursuing happiness, there's a kind of self-sufficiency that comes along with that. But he does conclude that the happy man does in fact need friends. And then he considers how many friends should a person have. And as you might guess, as what he said earlier, is that you have very few friends in this realm of friendship of goodness. And that's to be expected, because as he says, there's not very many people out there that are like this. And then in chapter 11, he considers whether one needs friends more in good fortune than in misfortune. And I found this to be really fascinating. So do you need friends more when you're going through bad things, or do you need them more when you're going through good things? And he describes the person who's going through misfortune as being very reluctant to reach out to friends, because that person doesn't want to be a burden. And I think that's a very human response. Whereas people that are having good fortune, many times they want to share that good fortune with others. And so they're quicker to invite others. What's fascinating about this, though, and I found this to be worth reading, if I can track it down here, maybe I didn't. He says, this is kind of how he resolves this issue. If you're reluctant to ask people to enter into your suffering with you, and if you're quick to ask people to celebrate with you, this is how we ought to think about this. Both of these figures ought to think about this. He says, conversely, it is perhaps fitting to go to a friend without having to be summoned, and indeed to go eagerly to those who are unfortunate. For it belongs to a friend to do some good, especially for those in need who do not expect it. For both parties, this is nobler and more pleasant. And so what he's saying there is, don't wait for people who are experiencing suffering to reach out to you, but be looking for people who are suffering and go to them and do something for them that's noble, and it will benefit both you and the person who's suffering the misfortune. So I thought that was really helpful and interesting. The one critique I would say as we conclude comes from a book by John Mark Reynolds, When Athens Met Jerusalem. And he writes this: in Four Loves, C.S. Lewis points out that Christianity introduced a new friendship, a fourth kind, love and friendship of an unlovable person who cannot love back. This love can transform and enable the recipient to become the true friend of the one showing this Christian love. Aristotle doesn't really have a category for that because of the reciprocal nature of friendship of pleasure and friendship of utility, and then because of the like-mindedness and goodwill that exists between friendships of goodness. He doesn't have a category really for loving somebody who's unlovable, which is an act he calls an act of hope that they might be redeemed, they might grow in virtue, they might, So I thought I would leave it at that, turn it over to Charlie for a concluding thought, unless there are comments or questions.
Anything we want to talk about before?
I might just make a couple comments, if that's okay. That's really interesting. So the other day I was on social media and Dave Ramsey had like a clip he put up online, and I don't always see his clips, so I didn't know how it popped up in the little reel section on Instagram or Facebook or whatever. And he had taken a call from a caller who said, yeah, I have a question. I'm just looking for some advice. In a lottery pool at work, I won the lottery with a group of people. And after we calculated after taxes and our split our winnings, I won $22 million. And I've only told one of my siblings and my wife. And Dave Ramsey, he's like, oh my word. He's like, well, I think I have some guesses, but why haven't you told anyone? And he said, well, the first thing we did, my wife and I, is we got on and we researched what happens to lottery winners. And like 4 out of 5 of them lose all the lottery and it wrecks their lives. And one of the things is that what happens is the reason they think that happens is you tell too many people. And then everyone's coming to your door wanting this, that, or the other thing. And then he said, we're not telling our kids. And Dave Ramsey said, I think that's great. And he says, I don't want my kids to grow up to be waiters. And this was just a funny joke that I'm sharing. And Dave Ramsey's like, what? And he says, well, waiters, like waiting for me to die. And he loses it. But it occurred to me that that's kind of talking about what Aristotle's saying. Like you have this friendship that isn't of utility, but now that this person has all this money, you see utility and it actually spoils whatever good friendship was there. And I thought, oh, that's like really a lot like what's going on here. And there's a lot of self-interest there that didn't appear and then appears as the money comes. I just thought that was an interesting comment to add. And biblically, yeah, my question was going to be, I have two questions for you. If a listener wanted to get a start with an easy Aristotle text, is there any easy Aristotle text that they could start with that you know of? Or is this like, nope, you got to dive in and be committed?
I think actually Nicomachean Ethics would probably be where I would encourage that person to start. There is no easy Aristotle text that I'm aware of. I should back up and say one thing that's good about him is he believes that truth exists out in the world and that thoughtful people can understand it and grasp it. And so he's just a really keen observer. The thing that makes him somewhat tricky is vocabulary. He uses terms in ways that are difficult sometimes to understand what he means. But if you have a text that has good notes, it'll help you navigate some of that.
That was my second question is, do you have any guides you'd recommend where, hey, I really am interested in Aristotle and I have been for a while. And now you're talking about this. Is there any guide you know of? If you don't, that's fine. We can always recommend one in the future.
Well, there is a collection and I forget what the series title is, but it's something about, you know, taking ancient classics and kind of making them more modern. And so there's an edition of that Poetics by Aristotle that somewhat modernizes the text a little bit.
Okay.
And there's a bunch of those books, other people that are, you know, from the ancient world. I have a couple copies from the University of Chicago and they have really good notes. There's an interpretive essay in the back of each one too. So his Politics, Rhetoric, and Nicomachean Ethics are all published by University of Chicago Press, and those are helpful editions.
Okay, thank you.
I would say, too, as I was recording last night a update or overview video for one of my classes in which I have them read what I consider a very difficult textbook, and there's differences of opinion about this difficult textbook. Like, well, why don't you use an easier textbook so that they can just so easily understand what you're trying to teach them? And there's merit to that. I also think in this specific realm, which is Bible lesson preparation, I'm trying to instill right away that if you want to do this, it's always going to be difficult. Like, there isn't an easy way to understanding truth and teaching it to someone.
Amen.
And so, and I tell them, like, this is intentionally a very difficult book. And so what with Aristotle, I feel that same, like, it would kind of demean it to try and like undermine it by making it easy. Like, it's meant to be a pursuit that takes a very long time. And it's why he's still regarded as a classic, that a guy can put all these volumes together over his lifetime, and it stands the test of time. But, you know, if he's writing it over 50 years, why do we think we're going to read it in a month or two and get it? You know, it's a life pursuit. But as you're talking about the different types of friendships, I've always categorized them this way: proximity, pleasure, and purpose. There's people you're friends with just because they're there, like my siblings, my neighbors, kids you go to school with, but that's pretty much about it. And then it kind of evolves into, well, I like these things, you like these things, and that transcends proximity or biology. But then the highest type of friend is, it's not what we necessarily want or desire, but it's, we share goals. We share trajectory. And when you can build relationships off of purpose, that, and it's very similar to what you said there. And that's good. And I wish I had crafted a final meditation that had more to do with friendship, but alas, it's not. So let's have a final meditation in James chapter 1, and doing some extended study here over the next year or two. And this is chapter 1:19-25. And just a couple introductory notes. We mentioned this a while back on the podcast, but as you try to think through a genre of James, obviously we know it's an epistle, you know, it's a New Testament epistle, one of the general epistles. But as you start reading commentaries, they notice that it has a very similar sort of feel to proverbial wisdom. So shorter, pithier statements, wisdom statements, and not always a connected whole. And you'll gather that as you read through commentaries. Very similar to Proverbs. I think it's just about 10 times, might be a little more, a little less. He addresses his readers. So in Proverbs, it's always my son. In James, it's my brothers. And you'll see in chapter 1, verse 19, there's one of the addresses there. My beloved brothers. And he repeats that address. There's only one time in the book of James that he addresses his readers as anything other than brothers, which is in chapter 4, where he calls them
adulteresses.
Adulterers. Like, yeah. So very, a very strong confrontation in chapter 4. And so I think you could rightfully organize the book of James by looking at the addresses he makes to the brothers. But I also think, you know, he is trying to be more in the wisdom sense. And so it's hard to find connections of one verse to another at times. But so I think 1:19-25 does fit together. And it's all about learning to be genuine followers of truth. And so I'll just read it and then I'll share a couple quick thoughts. So James 1:19. Know this, my beloved brothers. Let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. For the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Therefore, put away all filthiness and rampant wickedness, and receive with meekness the implanted word, which is able to save your souls. But be doers of the word, not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man who looks intently at his natural face in a mirror. For he looks at himself, goes away, and at once forgets what he was like. But the one who looks into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and perseveres, being no hearer who forgets, but a doer who acts, he will be blessed in his doing. And so, really, verses 19 through 21, it's kind of setting the table. And then 22 through 25, there's an illustration that helps make it practical. And so the kind of main command in verse 19, know this, Like, focus your attention on something. You should be quick to listen and slow to, I mean, you should be quick to bring things in, slow to push things out, in the sense of speaking and of anger. And it's interesting, we were just talking about the passions, and someone can get very passionately worked up over something and strive and strive and strive. And James actually admonishes them, verse 20, that your own anger over an issue will not produce righteousness. Like, you can be vehement on something, but that's not equivocal to genuine character, to genuine godliness. And so for that reason, there's something more important to you than being vehemently, passionately, you know, championing, you know, to use the vice we mentioned earlier, recklessly pursuing virtue. You should be first listening to what is true. You should not be talking. You should not be angry over things. You should be meditative and focusing on what's true. And you can notice, kind of in a wisdom, more poetic sense, how these verses are parallel with each other. So if you look at verse 19 and verse 19 and 20 with 21, so you have the exaltation of the listening versus the vice of speaking or being angry. And you have that same flow in verse 21. So rather than being the angry speaking fool, you need to receive the word. So put away the filthiness, receive with meekness the word. So it's almost a restating of what he just said in verse 19, where you need to be quick to listen, quick to receive, not quick to declare, to promote, you know, to be the speaker. You need to be a listener. And we won't really dive into the terminology of the implanted word, but it's a confidence that if it's planted, it will grow. It is kind of an idea there. But I think he does then draw a distinction with someone who gives an endorsement of the word to someone who does it. You know, so there is a difference between someone who is receiving it and hearing it and does nothing versus someone who receives it and acts. And so the illustration is very pointed. I do this every morning. You wake up and you look in the mirror. And especially when my hair gets a little longer, I have to be really careful that I don't walk out with, you know, how messy your hair is. And when it's cold, you put hats on or earmuffs or whatever. And there are times, it was a couple weeks ago, I was at work and I didn't even notice, but I went into the bathroom and looked in the mirror and my hair was just completely disheveled. And it's like, man, how did I not know that that's what I looked like? And you apply that picture spiritually, where James says, you don't want to be quick to anger. You don't want to be quick to speaking and declaring what you know is true. You want to be a careful listener, a careful observer, a careful receiver of the word. And one of the ways that you do that is as you look into it, you're being attentive. And one of the books we're reading for a class right now is The Seven Laws of Teaching. And it talks about the difference between a compelled attentiveness and an attracted attentiveness. And it's not that I'm doing this out of mere compulsion, but I have a genuine affection for knowing and paying attention to what's important. And the receiver of the word is dedicating affection, cultivating a love for seeing themselves in what is true. So looking into the law and seeing, looking for the messy hair and not forgetting about that, not walking away and doing nothing. But when you see in the mirror of the word that there's an issue, that you then become the one who acts upon it, not being a forgetful hearer, but a doer who acts. And so it's a really fun just reminder. You know, I think we rightfully so, you know, the word we use for our Bible study, devotions. Have you done your devotions today? And what would James think about doing your devotions? Is doing your devotions a contemplative time in the morning, maybe 10, 15, 20 minutes, where you're just reading? Or would a truly devoted doer be someone that's listening to that admonition throughout the day? and that your devotions actually extends into every arena of your life that day, that you spent the time looking into the law. You looked into the mirror and you saw, you were reminded. And then the whole rest of the day, you're doing what your Heavenly Father's asked you to do. And that's not just an external action. That's seeing what's wrong within, addressing misplaced desire, repenting of idolatry or immorality. But devotions is not, spending time in the Word is not just that time that I read for 15 minutes in the morning, but it's a pattern of my life that I would understand what's true and I would remind myself throughout the day to continue to be a doer of that virtue. And I think that's a really helpful picture. And you know, to carry around with you a mirror all day and keep looking at what's going on and don't forget what you look like, and or you're going to end up like me with really messy hair in class or at work. And so we'll come back to different portions of James, but I do think this passage becomes kind of the heart of the whole book of James, where he's providing avenues for people to see what they look like and give them opportunities to picture themselves with the truth. And so the encouragement here is to be quick to listen to the Word of God first and often, and don't forget what you look like. Be a doer of the Word. When you spend that time each day reflecting and meditating on truth, take it with you. And just to read verse 25 again, don't be the one who looks into the perfect law do not be a hearer who forgets, but a doer who acts, and you will be blessed in your doing as you pursue the truth genuinely that way. Thank you guys for listening to this week's episode, and we'll see you next week on another episode of the Thinklings Podcast. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.